then you might not clap. I had a wonderful opportunity to read here in August, I think it was, for a long time out of my book. This is the poem that's in this anthology, and I'm proud to be part of it. I had a house in Mill Street for 15 years. I just recently sold it because I'm trying to retire and get my finances together. And when I opened the shade every morning, what I saw was a Protestant ruin. It was a small park, and the belfry was there, and tiny towns had put a clock in the belfry. So what I saw was a clock in this tower. So this is titled The Clock Tower. Stone upon stone, the bell tower rises outside my window. A Protestant ruin of the village church. You belong to Tristan Castle, you belong to the people. The ringer gently bowed to the lintel, climbed narrow stone steps spiraling to call worshippers to communion. Years later, tidy towns filled your belfry with the white-faced clock. I raised the linen shade, wake to your dial, black Roman numerals go round and round. You move through my tea and egg. I notice the times I am off to the shop for the guardian and lamb. You are my companion as I play with poems and read passing through. I stroll in the deep grass, rubbing old tombstones, no longer legible. You move through my days until you wane in the light of the evening and fade at the unfairness of fate. These are two new poems, so I'm just trying this out. I've read from the book quite a bit before. I just celebrated a seminal birthday. I won't tell you which one, but it's way up there. And the older we get, the more we think about sex. So, yeah, true. This is an imaginary affair. Imaginary. This is a trip to Kilkenny. Are you thinking about sex? Do not touch, the sign read. For some, the eyes are the windows to the soul, but for you, it is your hands. I was touched by the way you touched each thing. You ran your fingers around the stones of the ice house, used to store salmon caught in the black water. You pulled the Montgomery to your face, smelled the blossoms. In Kilkenny Castle, you brushed your hands over the antique table, pressed the silk wall covering a rich embossed green, then picked up a silver knife from the place setting, felt its heft. Holding the glass case as if you could reach into the past, you studied the photo. Gosh, isn't that amazing, you said. In St. Canice's Cathedral, you traced the circle of the medieval baptismal font and the marble effigy of Margaret Butler. Caressed each closed eye, her cheeks, her hair, a slight smile on her lips as if she were your lover, her hands folded in prayer. And then you touched me. This one is also about the imaginary lover. And I decided I would sleep where this lover had slept. But then I noticed that his imprint was in the sheets and the pillow. So I didn't want to mess it up. So I wrote a poem about it, and I was afraid that the housekeepers would come in and change the move the sheets around, because I was looking at all the creases. So I took 12 photos of the sheets and the pillow so I could finish the poem. The imprint. Sheets as white as jasmine blossoms, the folds from your body like slow waves washing the strand. I traced the places where your shoulders lay. Rivulets run across the bed, your ribs pressed. The pillow is a little askew to the right. The roundness of your head as you slept on your side, facing away from me. In the pitch dark room, I knew you were there. I could hear your breathing, slight puffs, rhythmical. You left the scent of sweat, salty. I wanted to sleep where you had lain, but didn't want to change where all that was left were the creases for me.
Thank you, Sandra, for the wonderful poetry and that wonderful insight. I'm just standing, you know, thinking, if you told my 20-year-old self that the older I get, the more I think about sex, I'd be worried if I had enough room in my brain for any more. But that's just me. That's just me. I'll have you know, Sandra, I'll take that thought to bed with me tonight as well. So next up, to read some poetry and maybe make an argument for a younger man's sex, not as Edward O'Dwyer.
I'm going to start with a poem that I hadn't planned to read, but Sandra was reading poems about sex and bed sheets, and I have a poem about sex and bed sheets.
What a surprise.
Shocking developments here at Obey. There's an epigraph to this poem from the filmmaker David Siegel, and he says, "Fingerprint examiners routinely testify that they have 100% confidence in their results." This poem is called Fingerprint. As morning honeys through the blinds to find out what has happened, and you're gone to the kitchen for coffee, my mind is setting bright yellow tape around the bed. Investigation scene, do not cross. Is careful doing so, not to upset an atom within it, as if prepping the area for meticulous eyes, the teams of hotshot detectives and forensic specialists. I note all the evidence, piece by piece, the shape of your head and flattened pillow, the contours of your shoulders pressed in the ragged duvet. There too, the impressions of bum, heels, and faint lines of legs, arms, and back, the deep dents of my knees and hands, set in fabric like putty molds, an imprint of the love we've made. We'd be caught in no time, I'm thinking to myself, just as you're entering, two mugs in your hands, one of them held out to me. How could we ever hope to get away with it, I say to you, accepting the mug and looking still at the bed, like a fingerprint, conclusively, undeniably ours. That's from a book called The Ring on Cruises Street that I was delighted Jesse Lendeney published a couple of years ago. And I'm delighted she's going to publish another book of mine in April. So I'll read one poem to you from that book. It's a very, very different kind of book, and this is a very different kind of poem to the one you've heard. It's dark, so I'll get it out of the way. It's a poem in three parts called Biography. 1. You'll have known him just as well as anyone else, I'm sure, which is not well. His pale, desperate face that hovers at the edges of your photographs, and some kind of insistence that he exists, but you've never been quite convinced. The blank drawn in every sentence where memory fails, the detail left out of the story at the preference of another dot, dot, dot. Every internet search of no results found, his official biography, when that time has come, not likely to be more than a quiet fart in a deserted street on a windy day. You'll forget him as that guy who spent years going to nightclubs, filling girls with overpriced booze and as much schmooze, for rarely more than a false name or a false number. On good nights, a bit of a shift, but of course even then, this was the type of girl that shifted everyone and his brother, who in the sack probably did everything bar nothing, but at 3 a.m. as the rain came down, was always being sheepdogged into the back of a taxi by some other fucker, and probably the same guy that spilled his pint earlier without so much as a sorry. You'll almost, but not quite, recall him, perhaps once, for just a moment, as he is found at his tether's end with life, somewhere in his late 30s, that degree he got when things might still have gone the other way, all the years unused in the drawer in a small, cold room where the mildew on the walls has been closing in ever more each night of counting up bunches of change for a kebab, and all of the lads still not calling round, just like they never did all those times they said they definitely would. Going to do a few poems that are much more recent. This is a legitimate phobia, so I have to ask, is anybody here terrified of clowns?
My daughter is.
Well, recently, yes.
Is your daughter here?
Recently,
no, yes. Oh, what a pity. I was really hoping somebody here was terrified of clowns. Anyway, this poem is called Let's Say. Let's say it isn't out of your imagination that this grinning clown has come, red-nosed and floppy-shoed, up your driveway to where you and your wife are sharing the swing chair on the patio. Let's say this is real, happening, and like the best of clowns, this one is ambiguous, could be full of silly humor, and just as easily full of nastiness. Let's say he immediately produces a bouquet of flowers from one of his never-ending pockets, offers them to her with his perennial smile. Let's say she smiles, accepting them. Should you get jealous of such a thing? Could you lose her to him, the clown? Is it at all possible she has always hated your sense of humor, your failure to be self-deprecating, to willingly be the joke? Is she about to tell you it's over, that she and the clown are together, that he's here to pick her up for the rest of her life? And now, have you ever before felt so colorless in your sensible, well-to-do clothing from designer stores? Let's say then, he pulls a handkerchief from the same never-ending pocket, hands it to you. You've seen this part of the act before. You know the handkerchief goes on and on and on. Let's say then, she's gone. I took part in a collaboration with a visual artist recently under duress, as is the way with visual artists.
You mean, you know, reluctantly,
isn't it? I don't mean reluctantly, I mean under duress. I was a prisoner in the project. No, that's not true. Willingly. I had to respond to this video she sent me, and the video abstract doesn't quite cover it. But she asked me if it was a little too abstract, would I like her to send me something else, and I said no, actually, this is taking me way outside my comfort zone, and I think that's a good thing. I had no idea at that point what I was going to do with it, but I came up with something. It was a video called The Color Spectrum, but I related it to the Irish Catalan cyborg called Neil Harbison. don't know if you've heard of him, but this is the guy who was the first person to, in an official capacity, be deemed a cyborg. This is called Making Love to a Cyborg. You're not human anymore, but a kaleidoscope of color, shade, tinge. Your skin isn't what you thought it was. You still only see in pixels, not close enough, not into molecules. It's orange and flecked in yellows and crimsons and terracottas, imbued with the tones of egg yolks from every country around the world, every strain of chicken. It's shiny, like sun on brass. It glares, it shimmers, it chameleons. It is robust, muscular, when dripped upon by just a goblet of moonlight. It smudges in contact with shadow. It shocks and thrills at the attack of music. It dislikes the thesaurus meanings of words. They are too vague, imprecise, and accustomed to influency. You are X in an equation now. You know you are not human anymore because you've fallen in love with a cyborg. A human would never do such a thing. A man with an antenna coming from his head each day smiles at you from a garden, teeming with scent and buzz and chirp, and you know the choice you've made was the right one. Though he makes love to you in mathematics, frequencies, signals, according to coordinates he has obtained by a satellite's tilting, and a human would say it's not love. Of course, that's what a human would say. But you are not being made love to, however soft the kiss, however warm and gentle and wet and organic the tongue. But you know love. You've learned to calculate love. You can hold love up to the light now and see its definite watermark. It's the human you don't understand. The human is the glitch, the runaground. You found you'd spent your life being misdirected, wrong-footed by them, especially when they bring up love, which all of them do. You never met a single one you were sure knew what they were doing as they made love to you. You're simply tired of all their guesswork, tired of their answers taken from the back of a book. In order to provoke Stan, after he wagged his finger at me, you know, he loves running Limerick down. No, he doesn't. He loves Limerick. But I want to read a poem about Limerick. I was living in Galway for a year, and I missed Limerick terribly, so I moved back there. And I wrote this shortly after moving back there. And it's called "I'll Always See Your Beauty." Be patient with me, hometown of mine, and I will be patient with you. Don't be getting so defensive, we are not enemies. Your hang-ups are mine too, remember, not that it's you I'm holding accountable. I'll always see your beauty. Your raw and visceral beauty is always for me in clear view. Even when you are grey and belligerent, interminably grey, relentlessly belligerent. I walk your streets almost every day. You'll know my footsteps as none other than mine. Jesus, Limerick. Would you ever shut the fuck up? Let me get a word in edgeways. Can we not go through our lists of complaints again? Tomorrow is another day. The sun might just come out if you'd make the effort. Cheer the fuck up. Me. I'll always see your beauty. Your raw and visceral beauty can only be for me in clear view. I sometimes feel like I'm taking your hand, Limerick, as I do the walk of the three bridges. The worst could happen. My peace is made with that possibility. It hasn't yet. There was one time, I won't forget it, some gulls were ravenous there on the quay, taking apart the flesh of a pigeon, and I looked at it, then away. Found consolation, which is always there for the finding. Found a song in your swirl of noises. Found some softness among your sharp edges. You'll always be given to moods, but then what lady won't be? These days, perhaps more than ever, you are a lady. Though your hair gets matted, though your makeup smears from the crying, from all the damned weeping you do. You are emotional, of course, always feeling your face on every side by new and old frustrations, but what lady isn't emotional? You always write yourself before too long. There's such beauty in that alone. I swear I'll always see your beauty. Your raw and visceral beauty will always be for me in such clear view. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now have a band world set against them for the rest of the night. And finally, we have John W. Sexton.
I'm just going to read a few poems from the Salmon collection, the last one, and a poem that's in the anthology. I want to start with a poem that actually isn't my own. It's a version from the Italian. I haven't read this, I don't think I've read this poem actually in public. It happens a lot when you have a collection that you don't read every poem. I'm not sure if I've read this before. The reason I want to read it this evening is simply that recently I did a version of another poem by this poet. It's the Italian visionary poet Dino Campana. And the poem I'm going to read now is a version of his poem that I've rendered the title as Autumnal Garden. To the spectral garden, to the voiceless laurel with its green garlands, to the autumnal dirt, a final farewell. To the impenetrable, infertile terraces, ruddy in the final sun. Distant fertility cries in a harsh cacophony. It cries to the dying star that has stained the marigold borders with blood. Brass trumpets tear away the vacuum of silence. The river sinks into the sun-gilded sand. In the silence, glass statues stand, turned on their heels at the entrance and the exit of bridges. All former states are gone. From the distance, like a choir, tender and majestic, silence raises its breath to my balcony. And in the odor of laurel, in the bitter, failing stench of laurel, from between the statues immortal in the sunset, she appears to me, transcendent, here. I didn't say that that was a Muse poem and kind of an Italian Aisling, because when you pick up a poem in a book, you don't get a running commentary, do you? Anyway, this is from the anthology, and this is a piece called Minnow Mermaids as Blue. The minnow mermaids can fit 24 into the cupped palms of your hands. Beneath the surface of the pond, they are a choir of splintery light. Young boys have kept them in jam jars, listening to them sing plaintively when the moon shines bright on the sideboard, watched as they darkened over the weeks, became nothing but sluggish fish. A princess might keep one, just one, in a waxed purse full of water, a little darling to be shown to her friends, fed with midges or nibs of parsley. Princes have kept them in onyx basins as a council of prophecy. They swim to the left, bad luck, good luck if they swim to the right. Mixed luck if, while swimming in the river, one swims into your ear. Once there, she'll charm your mind. Sad luck, certainly, if two take an ear each. On summer days, they will frolic wantonly, showing no concern for the world, and it's many you'll see then squirming in the beaks of kingfishers. This is another poem not written by me. It was written by grass. Not the grass you smoke, just ordinary, mundane grass. But it was such... I had a gap in the poem, in my book, so I stole this poem written by grass. So it's my name. Grass. Along my flanks, edges of me are cool in the shadows of the trees. The rest of me is out in the sun, brightly green. I'm green everywhere, except when I'm not, but even in the withering of me, there's a memory of green. My name is synonymous with green, and like that colour, I'm innocence itself. Everything comes to me, for everything comes to the floor, and I'm the floor of everywhere. Even beneath the sea, you'll find a version of me. But most of the time, you'll find me here, wherever you happen to be. I'll be waiting. I remain here for everyone. It is said that I cover the dead. And actually, I do. But I much prefer the living. And the living I live for most is my darling love. She steps barefoot onto me, walks my length. I feel myself cooling under each step. Then she undresses and begins to lie down. First, I feel the shadow of her shape. And then her shape. I could grow into this. Usually I do. Okay, just two more. I got the idea of this poem actually by mishearing what somebody said. There was a poet called Mark Whelan and another Mark Liddy, and they were pissed as farts one night, and they were outside the White House pub, and they were holding on to a lamppost, one arm each, and they were swung around the lamppost facing each other, and they were following each other, one was following the other and the other was backing, and they were dancing around this lamppost talking to each other. Pissed as farts, as I said, and Mark Liddy said something, and as he said it, I actually heard it before he finished saying what he was going to say. You know that thing where you finish somebody's sentence? And what I thought he said was, we invented the elephant. And it's brilliant. I thought, that's fucking brilliant. But then, my mind had finished that, you see, and then he actually said what he said, and what he said was, we invented the elevator. And I thought, well, that's not actually as good as what I thought you were going to say. So then I decided, oh, fuck it, I'm going to write that. That'd make the beginning of a poem. Anyway, this is the poem, and it's for Mark Liddy. it's only fair really, as I stole his line. And it's the secrets of the elephant. We invented the elephant so that it, with its wrinkled arse, we could leave an enormous enigmatic thumbprint on your front lawn. We invented the elephant so that mice could travel through the tunnel of its nostril on their holiday to the lung. We invented the elephant so that beetles could carry steaming suns of dung into their dark larders of earth. We invented the elephant so that we could open the shells of peanuts with the utmost extravagance. We invented the elephant so that there would be some creature, at least, who could remember why we invented the elephant.
John, was it John Liddy or Mark Liddy?
Mark Liddy, John Liddy's brother, and Mark Whelan, two Marks. I'm glad I was able to clarify. Okay, I'm just going to finish with this. It's actually the last poem in this collection, but that's not why I'm finishing with it. It's called The Way Back. That grey cat sleeps in the dusty spaces of the moon's face. She never stirs a limb while the moon's lit up, but only rises on moonless nights. She is the starlight's whim, and may be glimpsed as troubled waves through grass, or the sheen of ice on a distant pond. Holding your gaze are eyes as bland as glass. She'll mesmerize you till your heart's beyond the threshold of the living. In the hedge, you'll awake no thicker than a shadow. You'll die this way 9 times 9 to the edge of disappearance. The next thing you'll know is you're a kitten. You'll climb the night stairs as high as you want, your fur bright as stars.